From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Hillary is announcing her presidential campaign again. This time, she's doing it on an island. Will Marco Rubio sail her there on his luxury speedboat? And Jeb Bush had a week that might make him wish he could sail far, far away. Fortunately, he's in Estonia. Hello and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. Today we'll discuss all that, plus the Republican Party's push to appeal to black voters and House Democrats rebuking President Obama on trade. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com. On the right, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. Welcome to all of you. So let's start with Jeb. This week, excerpts resurfaced from a 1995 book where he argued that what this country needs is a revival of shame, that if people felt ashamed to have children out of wedlock, for example, families would be stronger. Rich, this story is odd in that we now sort of talk about whether Jeb is too much of a squish to win the Republican nomination. But when he entered politics in 1994, it was really with much more of a hard conservative edge, at least tonally.
That's right. And he softened a little to win in 1998 down in Florida. And he's catching heck for this now and seems so far to be standing by it. And just in sheer electoral calculations, I think what he needs actually is fights with the left and with the media rather than with his fellow conservatives. So maybe this is one for him to pick. And I think he's basically right. There's the stigma associated with having children before you're married eroded over time, and that accounts for, in a large part, for the explosion in unwed parenthood. And it wasn't that people in foregone ages were much more virtuous. You look at the estimates of how many women were pregnant at the time they got married, and it was off the charts. It was just a societal norm that you had to get married once you're pregnant, and that, for better or worse, I think mostly worse, is eroded away.
But I think, you know, in terms of him sticking by this, what he said that when he was asked about this in Europe is, you know, he was talking about men not sticking with the women who bear their children, which actually is not what he said in the book. He was talking about both men and women in the book. But in general, he sort of walked back this vintage 1994 Jeb stuff when he said, for example, that he did not want to see, quote, sodomy be elevated to the same constitutional status as race and religion. There was an incident in 1994 where a black voter had asked him, what would you do for African Americans as governor? And his answer was probably nothing. And it seems like there was a very concerted effort starting in 1998 when he ran again for governor and won that time. To actually really, you know, to be, you know, softer Jeb. So it seems to me like he's really not sticking by.
Well,
this stuff.
That's true about the shift from 94 to 98. It's also true that this is, you know, political ages ago, and no one really would talk starkly as he did in that book about this now.
So, Kelly, we were talking before the air, and you were actually sticking up for Jeb on this issue.
Well, be very careful, because I wasn't sticking up for all the sodomy comments, et cetera. But what I did say, and I stand by this, is that people treat stigma like it's a dirty word today, and I don't think it is, or nor should it be. I mean, we stigmatize all sorts of behavior that's terrible for culture. For instance, the reason no one smokes in offices and blows it in our faces today is because secondhand smoking and subjecting the rest of us to it is stigmatized. The reason people make less racist comments in social company at dinner parties is because we've stigmatized that type of behavior. And so when you're talking about out-of-wedlock births, which have had a particularly dire effect on my community, the African-American community, I have no problem with stigmatizing that behavior, in part because my mother believes that there should be more stigma around the behavior. And she was a single unwed mother before she married my father and had me. And she talked about the fact that the reaction of her family to her pregnancy at the time and saying, we love you. Of course, we're going to love this baby, but we're disappointed because we wanted more for you. And that stayed with her, resonated with her, and it really helped her change her life. And she said, that's completely gone. In fact, one of the things that she said to me on more than one occasion is how it drives her insane to hear that there's a high schooler who's pregnant. People are saying, we're having a big baby shower. We're having a big baby shower. Like, that's a really great thing. It's not that people who are single parents are bad bad people. Like I said, my mother's one, and I think she's perfect, if I do say so myself. But the fact is, the numbers don't lie, and those children are more likely to grow up in poverty. They're more likely to have less of a chance at the American dream.
Just a quick point. I know Bob wants to get in. I think the way you have to deliver this message, though, now is telling women how much harder it will be for them, rather than explicitly going out and using that language of Bush in 94 about shame and judgment, which just doesn't work in the current cultural environment.
Interesting, in part because there was this study about how the show Teen Mom, the show's 16 and pregnant and Teen Mom on MTV, which had come under criticism from social conservatives about this idea that maybe they glorified teenage pregnancy. There was a study actually saying that they reduce rates of teenage pregnancy because teenagers rationally look at those shows and go, gee, that doesn't look like something I feel like doing. But I feel like that's different from stigma. I think it's fine to tell people something is difficult. But there's when you go beyond that, and stigma sort of involves saying that you're a bad person for doing something. It doesn't involve saying that you're the worst person.
I think culturally, though, we're dealing with two extremes right now, because we have basketball wives. We have these types of shows which are not Teen Mom and saying, look how hard it is, but saying this is actually a decent goal to get pregnant out of marriage and just either hope that it's a paycheck or it can lead you to a glamorous life. And so there needs to be another end. And so I think saying it can be hard, it's not a great choice, is the other end of those extremes. But I think that you make a great point.
I don't know, Bob, what do you make of this and the sort of the return of trying to establish?
I think it's such a wonderful, wonderful chatty discussion about who you're going to stigmatize as the only bastard on the show, as somebody who was in fact born to an unwed working class mother who had a choice of an illegal abortion or having me. She couldn't. My father was in a family that he was unhappy with, but one could not get a divorce thanks to the grip of the Catholic Church on politics in New York and much of the United States. I've researched this whole history of how we treated the bastards, the illegitimate people. They're not allowed to have property, discriminated against through centuries. And I must say, the wisdom, at least, of the church and major religions in recognizing that we bastards have souls, that we have potential, that we should not be guilty. The stigma does not just go to the mother. And by the way, why you want to stigmatize some 16-year-old after a decision that she probably did not have full control or knowledge over? And one should stress birth control. One should stress education to avoid such things. But the fact of the matter is, the people who get stigmatized are the children who are born. And according to the major religions, which we pay homage to, and George Bush and Jeb Bush have, we're supposed to have souls that are worthy of anyone. We're supposed to have potential that is worthy of anyone, and we're all supposed to be treated as God's children. So let's not throw this stigma around, whether we're talking about gay people or we're talking about children born out of wedlock. You know, we're supposed to all be treated with respect. That hasn't happened in the treatment of this issue historically.
In part because men have not been stigmatized. And I actually think that's a big part of it. I think that people shouldn't be running around dropping babies everywhere. And that, to me, is part of the conversation.
I think stigma is a bad word to use here if it's not what you really mean, though. I think it's fine to try to, you know, encourage people to make good life decisions. But that's different from, I mean, stigma involves, like, shame. And the word that Jeb Bush used himself in this book was shame.
I don't think
shame
is always a bad thing.
Well,
that's where we just disagree, I guess, is that I actually think if you want to discourage behavior, sometimes saying that is not smart, it's not ideal, it will make you look bad, it's not a bad thing to
say. Well, but shame also makes people feel bad about themselves and be unhappy. We want people to be happy. We want people to be happy in a way that is, you know, we want them to be affirmed, and we want them to make good decisions. And it's a matter of how do
you think
actually
the athlete,
arrive at
the
that.
Houston Rocket, who just had announced his eighth kid out of wedlock, is someone we shouldn't be shaming for unideal behavior?
Well, I mean, I don't know the specifics of an individual person.
Let me answer that, by the way. No, let me respond to that. The behavior will be how that child is treated. What responsibility does the father take to that child? What kind of nurturing of that child? You're leaving out this important element in the discussion about whether you're shaming the 70% or what have you of children in certain situations, certain socioeconomic situations, who end up being born out of wedlock.
We agree more than we disagree.
Well, I hope so. What I'm saying
because the Houston Rocket
the,
is not. These are not poor kids. I'm focused on the parents who are making sloppy decisions.
Right.
And
so
that
you should
very few people talk about it. You know.
First of all, there's nothing wrong with the decision to have a child out of wedlock, as long as you support that child, as long as you show love, as long as that child is nurtured. Then that's a different issue. The question is, what is going to happen to that child? And we've had a very punitive policy towards children born out of wedlock, children born in poverty. That's what welfare reform represented. Yeah.
I unfortunately want to move on to another topic of personal behavior that has been in the news this week, which has to do with Marco Rubio, who there was actually in the publication I work for, the New York Times, there was an article about Marco Rubio's personal finances. And there's been a lot of discussion this week about whether there's really anything in Marco Rubio's personal finances that people who are not Marco Rubio or his banker should care about. Particularly, there was the focus on the $80,000 boat that Marco Rubio bought after receiving his $800,000 book advance and whether that was a luxury speedboat or whether it was just a fishing boat and how expensive a boat has to be a luxury. But I don't know, Rich, what did you make of this conversation that seemed to – a lot of the stuff in Marco Rubio's finances looks very normal for an American family, like student debt and mortgages and making real estate investments that were not the best investments you could possibly have made.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple things here. One, with all due respect to your publication, Josh, this story landed with a thud in part because of the prior expose of Marco Rubio's parking tickets.
Speeding tickets.
Four at over 17 years, I believe, which is probably not very unusual in most of the country, especially not in Miami. No offense to our Miami listeners. But you're right. I think Rubio's finances are fairly typical. The Times characterized them in as hostile a manner as possible, but he had $150,000 in student loan debt. Is that something we're really going to borrow a term from a prior conversation, shame Marco Rubio over? He did get overextended on real estate. He bought houses with little or no cash down, three of them. Not particularly unusual, unfortunately, in the mid-2000s, or we never would have had a housing bubble. And the so-called luxury speedboat was characterized in the New York Times. If you actually look at a picture of it or read or listen to a video review of it, it is just a fishing boat. Now, I think the two things that could hurt him, this has helped him so far, and can help him if he continues with the narrative, look, I'm not rich, I've had struggles with everyone else. One, the way his personal and party expenses were mingled on this party credit card in Florida is just perfect fodder for a negative campaign ad, even if it was just sloppiness and there was no element of corruption to it. And two, the problem for a candidate like Rubio, because he's so young and youthful seeming, is an unsteadiness. So if the finances are brought in to accent that kind of narrative, if it's given oxygen by other things he says or does, then it could hurt him as well.
Well, I think there was a third thing also, which is that a key way they've stabilized their finances is that his wife has been working for this man, Norman Brayman, who is a wealthy benefactor of Rubio's campaigns. And I don't know, Bob, what do you make of this as sort of the intertwining of his finances with a wealthier man? Rubio's been out there saying, look, I'm not rich like Hillary Clinton, so I have to find a way to finance my life like a normal American. But this kind of doesn't feel like the way a normal American finances their life.
Well, actually, Bill and Hillary Clinton, started out with more modest means, but they also had the Madison loan scandal, and they also found a way to survive in America. The whole question is, are you trumpeting an image of the morality of the free market, sink or swim, justice prevails, or are we all in this sloppy mess here with finances? And he has tried to take this idea that he knows the market, he believes in free enterprise and virtue will triumph. Yes, it will triumph if, like you're one of the Bushes, you were born on third base and you claimed you hit a triple. But if you have to deal with the reality that most Americans deal with, you're going to have messy finances. So, it's difficult for a free market purist to take that position. Secondly, you've put your finger on it. He's got a sponsor. Do we want politicians who solve their problems by turning to a rich person in their community and then carrying water for them? That's the real issue here that the New York Times revealed, and that's the only significant issue.
So, Kelly, the another candidate who's in the news is Hillary Clinton, because she's in the news most of the time. And she's going to announce her campaign this weekend.
I didn't know she was running. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, this is news we've been really waiting for. But so the way her campaign's been talking about is they're going to, you know, solidify their message for her as a progressive leader and whatnot. Is there anything you're looking to hear from Hillary Clinton that we have not yet heard?
Look, we know that a lot of the modern day campaigns have become essentially performance art or kabuki theater or something, you know, where there are all these events and stagings and speeches that we may not really need but have to be done. And so I think for her, she's really at a point where it's about locking down the base that they probably assume they would already have locked down by this point. And yet I'm guessing their internal polling is showing they do not, that there is room for concern. For instance, there was that speech she did, which I thought was an excellent speech at Columbia University a couple weeks ago, really focusing on criminal justice reform and that sort of thing. There was the recent op-ed, I think, that Jesse Jackson wrote. All of these things are telling all of us, I think, that there are concerns probably early on that they're trying to address. And so, you know, as a woman, as an African American, there are specifics I'd like to hear from her that contradict sort of the perception that a lot of white Democrats tend to wait until a couple weeks before the election and show up at churches and show up at feminist events to sort of say, hi, by the way, don't forget to vote for me. And I think that's the kind of stuff I'm looking to hear from.
Well, let us know what you think about shame and speedboats at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, how Republicans can appeal to black voters and the president loses on trade. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, is on the right, and Kelly Goff of the Daily Beast is also with us. So, Kelly, you wrote for the Daily Beast earlier this month about Republicans and the black vote, and you argued that the black vote could be more up for grabs than it is. What do you think Republicans can do to make inroads with black voters?
Well, some of the stuff they're already doing, which is, for instance, you have the African-American Republican Senator Tim Scott, who's really pushing hard on the body cameras issue, because criminal justice reform is something that's resonating more with African-Americans than I've heard in any election cycle, including in my own family, where they're saying they want to hear candidates talk about that. So that's going to be a really important issue. But also school choice in charter schools. There was polling, you know, that I saw in Jersey that showed that African-American parents are actually substantially more likely to support charter schools and issues like that. And so charter schools, criminal justice reform, if Republicans can really stake out a believable, territory on that, then I think that actually gives them an edge, not to obviously win the black vote, quote unquote, or get Barack Obama numbers with African-American voters. But George W. Bush showed they don't have to. They just have to sort of peel off enough in key swing states, which is what he did in Ohio in 2004 by getting, you know, double digit African-American voters, Florida, too.
You know, when people talk about, and also when people talk about Hispanic voters, there's sort of this question of, you know, are there like specific black issues and Hispanic issues that are the important vote drivers, or is it broader philosophy of government stuff? And particularly Pew does these polls every so often where they ask people this question, do you prefer a larger government providing more services or a smaller government providing fewer services? And the population as a whole tends to say a little bit more smaller government, but there's a huge racial divide on it. And white voters strongly prefer, or at least by a wide margin, prefer a smaller government. And then black voters and also Hispanic voters by about a 3-to-1 margin say they prefer a larger government providing more services. So I guess my question is Republicans' principle, the main reason Republicans do badly with black voters, is it about, you know, perceptions of anti-black sentiment and about these specific issues that are of disproportionate importance to black voters? Or is a lot of it simply just that broad philosophical disagreement that black voters tend to prefer a larger government and Republicans?
I think you can't separate the two. And here's what I mean by that. I wrote a piece once about why more African Americans aren't libertarians. And one of the examples I give is a plane crashes. There's one hospital in the town it crashes in. That hospital announces they don't treat African-American patients, and I'm near death. I ask my libertarian friends, do you believe that the government has a responsibility to say to that hospital, you are not allowed to turn her away? And that's what I mean by you can't separate the two. Part of why some more African Americans want larger government is because we worry about things like that. Because 50 years ago, which isn't that long ago, the government was needed to address things like that. Then, of course, there's what you mentioned before, the Southern strategy, which unfortunately some Republican strategists engaged in and helped elect, you know, President Richard Nixon and others. You have people like my parents who have not forgotten about that. That's their generation. So I think the party has some work to do in terms of doing what Ken Mellman did effectively in front of the NAACP and saying we have a history we need to apologize for, but we're willing to address that history, own it, apologize, and move forward on these specific issues. And I think they actually have a chance.
Bob, when you look at a candidate like Rand Paul, he has an interesting combination on this in that he's gotten very out front on certain issues of importance to black voters, especially on criminal justice, arguably more so than most Democrats have. But on the other hand, he's taken positions on economic issues that are well far to the right within the Republican Party. And how do you see that combination of issues playing with black voters who might look at it on average and say, well, I like the criminal justice stuff, but not the size of government stuff?
Well, then I don't think they understand the libertarian critique of crony capitalism, because the people who suffered the most as a result of something Jesse Jackson supported, the reversal of Glass-Steagall and all the deregulation of the banks, real wealth of the black community declined by 50% as a result. The Latino community, it was closer to 80%. So the people who got really hurt in the whole banking meltdown were, in fact, minorities. And the critique of crony capitalism is, which Rand Paul is not the only libertarian, but is a strong critique, is that we're not talking about a free market. We're talking about a system that favors the super wealthy and the minorities that hurt. I would add that there's a number of other issues, some of which we're going to discuss in terms of trade. But the main, the prison reform is obviously important. We have a discriminatory system and we've criminalized a large part of the black male population. But the other is we've destroyed a trade union movement that was opening to blacks, and particularly in the industrial community and part of the economy, the auto and steel and so forth. And this was the avenue for increased economic opportunity. And so these trade issues and the destruction of really the need for a certain American working class at this time came at a time when it would have benefited blacks. And that's a big struggle. The economic questions are very real in this issue.
Rich, what do you think Republicans' diagnosis is of why Republicans get so little of the black vote?
Well, I think that history is obviously a huge part of the answer, and you've both touched on this. But the federal government and the assertion of federal power have been very good for blacks. The Union Army was an army of liberation during the Civil War. The last spasm of the Civil War was a civil rights movement, which succeeded with the help of the federal government. And the bete noir of the conservative movement is the federal government and federal power. So you just have a big disconnect there, and it goes to the size of government issue. And that's why, you know, I hail Rand Paul going out and making the case on the war on drugs, which I agree, you know, there's been overkill there, and on prison reform and all the rest of it. But what he never gets around to telling these black audiences, you know what, all things considered, I'd eliminate Social Security if it were just up to me, and I have constitutional problems with part of the Civil Rights Act. But look, the party has to go out and make its case. It should make its case to everyone about how its program is better for the country. It should especially emphasize, as Kelly noted, school choice and giving parents better options than they have now in the monopoly schools. And just in sheer political terms, just dampening the historic levels of support for President Obama will be a big electoral benefit if they can manage it.
I want to get to one final topic. As we went to tape on Friday, the House of Representatives had dealt a significant blow to President Obama's trade agenda. Nancy Pelosi announced her opposition to trade adjustment assistance, which was an essential part of the overall package to ultimately get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed. And House Democrats followed her, rejecting it by an overwhelming margin. It got only 126 yes votes in the House, 302 no votes. Bob, are you surprised about this? The president lobbied very hard to try to get this trade bill through over objections from the left.
Well, I'm surprised that we have some integrity on the Democratic side of things. Yes, it's long overdue. And certainly Nancy Pelosi breaking with the president was very important. And the issue here was not the specifics of the bill. It was giving the president this authority. There were some good things in that specific bill as far as wage adjustment. But the real issue here is you have a secret agreement on trade that will transform the world markets. And it takes away the right of people within our own society to insist on certain standards applying. And we can go through all the issues. But it even gets to Philip Morris being able to prevent people from educating about the dangers of smoking. And the question is, who's the we? And the fact is that there's a great feeling in this country now, and if Democrats don't respect it, Republicans will learn to, which is that most Americans are being screwed by these agreements. They're being screwed by international trade. They're not benefiting. That's why income is not getting more equal. That's why opportunity is declining. And people are increasingly suspicious of these agreements, particularly when they're secret and they represent a giveaway to big corporations while ignoring the interests of ordinary Americans.
You know, Rich, David Frum tweeted something interesting earlier today, which was that it's not surprising that as incomes get more unequal, it's harder to get broad support for measures that grow the economy. That, you know, there's been this elite consensus in favor of trade for decades. Actually, in 1998, when Bill Clinton's trade promotion authority was getting renewed, he got almost no Democratic support for it, but Republicans lined up for him in a way that clearly was not possible for Barack Obama today. But sort of, you know, even if people buy the idea that trade agreements grow the economy, how do you sell to people that they're a good idea if people say a bigger economy doesn't mean a bigger paycheck for me?
I think that's part of it, but the Democrats have been pretty anti-trade, as you point out, since the late 1990s. And in the Senate, you saw a pro-trade consensus holding up. In the House, it was much more difficult, in part because you had an element of the House Republican caucus, which is more populist on these issues, but also just out of sheer distrust of President Obama. And what happened with this vote on the trade assistance is either very canny or very cynical, depending on how you want to look at it. But Democrats voted against a program they basically support. They might have some issues on how it's funded, but they basically support this idea, and they brought it down because they realized that with the procedural complexities, this was the greatest weakness in the trade promotion authority itself and was the easiest way to take it down. I think they'll take another shot at it, and we'll see whether it can get through or not.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
By the time I read my third article comparing John Kerry's boat to Marco Rubio's boat, I decided I was ready for this presidential election season to be over. So my rant is on stupid stories, stupid coverage when we have very serious stories like a number of citizens who are unarmed being shot in the streets and we still haven't figured out how to address it.
Bob Scheer, your soapbox.
Yeah, where's Hillary on trade? I think Bernie Sanders is mounting a very serious challenge. I noticed he picked up 41% in Wisconsin in Democratic straw vote. And I think maybe we're ready for some social democracy. Maybe Germany or the Scandinavian countries are the model and not the free market republicanism of Goldwater that Hillary Clinton supported as a young person.
Rich Lowry, you're right.
Never forget, Bob. I want to hail American Pharoah, winner of the Belmont Stakes and the Triple Crown. It was such a wonderful moment because it really brought the country together, just celebrating sports excellence, shorn of any tribal or partisan loyalties. I admit that if American Pharoah were Boston Red Sox, I would hate him with a passion. But congratulations to American Pharoah, a beautiful and elegant creature.
Well, so I did a exciting thing this week. I traveled to Virginia to read Carly Fiorina's state income tax returns. In 2013, Carly Fiorina and her husband made about $2.5 million. They had to pay income tax in 17 states. In 11 of those states, their tax bill was less than $250. This is a uniquely American stupidity where governments all over the country come after little bits of your income and then tax them and rebate them and whatever. In Canada, they have a much better system, which is you pay income tax to whatever province you live in. If Carly Fiorina were running for Prime Minister of Canada, I would have never seen a 58-page tax return to some province reflecting a liability of $40. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Kelly Goff. Thanks to Laura Dine Million, who produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Pajamas.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
Well, we know we need.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.